Good stuff. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Monday. It's the 18th of November. Very nice to see you all. Thank you very much. Well, we don't see you because it's radio, but you know what I mean. Now, very nice to have you with us, and we feel your presence, and that's important. Good morning, all, and welcome. It's really, really nice to be back. I hope you all had a lovely weekend and did all the cool stuff or not. I was just telling the group I was trying this weekend to disengage for a little while, for the weekend, just to disengage from everything. So like Friday at noon to last night to seven, I disengaged, and which wasn't hard, and it was nice at the time. But when I reengaged, I didn't really miss anything. Like I was like, oh, that's cool. Like there was no major, you know what I mean? No, okay. Meaning that I didn't, like, I thought I was going to look at it and say, oh God, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is now, you know, ambassador to life, and that didn't turn out to be the case. Yeah.
Well, disengagement doesn't do you much good if, for relaxation, you're watching the Jets.
Well, and I did watch the Jets. That's absolutely true. I did watch the Jets. Although the best, you know, my niece is going to the University of South Carolina, so I've been watching the Gamecocks.
The Gamecocks, yeah.
Oh my God, were they great last? The last three games have been tremendous, but they played Missouri on Saturday night. The game was amazing. Just stunning.
Wow.
Really, really good stuff. So that made me happy. I hope you all had a happy weekend as well. We're going to introduce the group, and then we'll get into our discussion at large here. Let me just remind you, you can always be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Sienna Freeman Tolbert joins us, and Sienna is partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
Good. Yeah. I've been trying to decide whether I should turn off my breaking news notification as well.
Yeah.
On my phone, I'm waffling. I'm going back and forth. I haven't decided yet, but I'm leaning towards yes.
All signs point to yes. Yes. I don't know, and you can turn them on and off. You know, you can black out for a little while, and come back, see what happens. Fred Hoff is here. He's an ambassador. Fred Hoff, former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat, taught at Bard for quite a while, and now he's at Bard's Center for Civic Engagement. Good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, Joe. Doing fine. Happy to be here.
Really nice to have you here. Also, speaking of Bard Center for Civic Engagement, we welcome Jim Ketter, a senior fellow at that center. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Happy to be here.
Very nice to have you on the program. All right. Let's begin and talk about what is in the news. And, there's plenty of stuff. Don't worry. Things happened yesterday. So let's begin with the approval by President Biden, the approval of Ukraine's use of long-range U.S. weapons inside Russia. This reverses a policy. The Biden administration will allow Kyiv limited use of ATACMS. Is that how would,
yeah,
you...
Yeah, the acronym is ATACMS.
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 Well, I like that.
Yeah.
Oh, I like that. You know, you take two of those, you can usually get rid of the indigestion. Good to strike enemy positions in Russia, according to senior U.S. officials. President Biden made this authorization to use the long-range weapons for limited strikes inside Russia. The easing of restrictions and allowing Kyiv to use the Army Tactical Missile System to hit targets inside Russia is a significant reversal in U.S. policy and comes as some 10,000 elite North Korean troops have been sent to Kursk, a region of Russia along Ukraine's northern border, to help Moscow's forces retake territory gained by Ukraine. The Biden administration fears that more North Korean special forces units could follow in support of this effort. Ambassador Hoff, how big a deal is this?
Well, I think it, you know, at least on the margins, it can help the Ukrainians tactically This was not a system that I was familiar with when I was on active duty, so I took the liberty of looking up some Army literature on it, and listeners might want to know what we're talking about here. This Army tactical missile system is a series of short-range, road-mobile, solid-propellant-fueled, surface-to-surface ballistic missiles developed, obviously, by the United States. It first saw use during the 1991 Persian Gulf War. It's a tactical system designed to attack high-value targets of rear echelon forces, like airfields, surface-to-air missile sites, artillery missile forces, supply areas, and command groups. The firepower is enormous. It has a it has a conventional warhead. It has one that can break into many pieces. I'm reliably informed that if you're hit by one of these things, it'll ruin your whole day. I think that permitting Ukraine at long last to use these tactical missiles, which has been linked by the administration to the deployment of North Korean forces in Russia. But to use these missiles against military targets inside Russia, I think it's part of a pattern that may prove, from the Ukrainian standpoint, to be too little and too late. We saw the same pattern with Abrams tanks, F-16 aircraft. Months and months and months of arguing that Ukraine did not really need this stuff, only to decide, ultimately, to provide it. And I think from the beginning on Ukraine, we've conceded a lot of escalation dominance to Russia. By this I mean, we have allowed Vladimir Putin's thinly veiled threats of going nuclear.
Right.
To constrain our own willingness to give Ukraine what it needs to inflict maximum damage on the Russian military. Putin is a rationally cynical actor. When President Biden announced publicly at the beginning of the war that he would do everything possible to avoid conflict between two nuclear powers, Putin, being Putin, interpreted this as weakness, as a vulnerability that could be exploited by hinting at going nuclear and modifying Russia's doctrine on the use of nuclear weapons. And I think what this teaches us is that our leaders really need to learn the merit of silence and strategic ambiguity. Do I think Ukraine is worth fighting a nuclear war over? Of course not. But I think the best way to avoid nuclear war is to avoid projecting fear, indecision, and weakness.
I feel like I have to ask this question, but the fact that this was a reversal of policy and the timing of this reversal of policy after the election and in the waning days of the Biden administration, I assume that's on purpose.
Oh, yes. Yes. I mean, the public explanation centers on the presence of North Korean forces. And, surely if these missiles can hit, the North Korean command centers in Russia and other North Korean related targets, it's all to the good. But I don't know for a fact, Joe, but I just don't know if Vice President Harris had won. I'm not sure this decision would have been made. But the Biden administration is going to make a maximum effort in the time remaining to it to make sure the Ukrainians have virtually everything they're asking for, and then leave it up to President Trump to make whatever policy adjustments he wants to make.
Jim?
Yeah, following on that, so, Donald Trump J.D. Vance, Tulsi Gabbard, they've all made it exceedingly clear that they want to negotiate on this issue of Ukraine. And I just heard some statements from Gabbard where she's talking about, you know, bringing peace to Ukraine through these negotiations. The question is, what kind of peace? What would a negotiation really look like? And what would it result in for what would remain of Ukraine? And I say that because some of this, a good portion of this fight, on one level, is about territory. And so Ukraine has gone into what is really a strategically unimportant part of Russia, but it's all part of the game to position Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia for the coming diplomatic negotiations that I think probably would have happened in some form, even if Harris had won. And so, you know, people often think about diplomacy versus the use of force. The reality is that these are things that go together hand in glove. And so preparing to have the upper hand in terms of, or at least have a solid hand in terms of negotiations, finding ways to leverage the use of force into Russia. The ATACMS are one element of it. The Ukrainians have developed their own drones that have a lot less firepower, but a lot greater range, and a lot and have been doing some of that. The administration behind the scenes is trying to lean on them to not carry out certain attacks, but that might be off too. It might not just be about the ATACMS. Another part of this too, that I think Biden is trying to put in place and to have it stay in place even after he leaves and Trump takes over, is that this also greenlights our NATO partners to also take their restrictions off of the Ukrainians on the use of these weapons outside of a defensive posture. So a lot of it is, you know, as Fred said, you know, the public story is it's about the North Korean troops, and but there's many other layers of this game that is being played at the same time. And so the NATO partners, the other weapons, you know, positioning for coming negotiations. I think that's all in play at the same time.
Sienna?
I mean, I think, you know, obviously I agree with Fred and Jim, and I think they made very good points about the NATO aspect and the negotiation aspect and those different things. I like to think about it from a global aspect, because what I'm looking at is, how is the world looking at us right now? What's going on? And I think they're trying to figure out where the U.S. stands, right? We had the weird response from Russia when Trump was elected initially. He didn't know where Putin stood necessarily. You know, he was happy. He was always waiting for this election. But you're trying to read the tea leaves when it came to Russia and Trump and where that was going, right? And I think that what Biden is trying to do in these last few days is trying to, in my opinion, send a signal to our allies that we're going to do our best to support Ukraine and with what's happening, especially in light of, I was thinking about the Tulsi Gabbard nomination. I was thinking, that's when I saw that and I saw this happen, I thought there was some kind of, you know, line of logic going on there. Maybe not. Maybe people think that these nominations are just, you know, thrown out there to test the Senate, but I don't. I think that the presidential administration is taking it very seriously, and I think that might be a part of it as well.
Wow.
I just want to follow up on one thing, too, that Sienna reminded me of as the world looks on. Two pieces of information that I think are important to keep in mind. One is our own defense posture in a highly complex world. So it's interesting that kind of buried deeper in these stories about what Biden was announcing vis-a-vis the Ukrainians and allowing them to use these weapons is that we're supplying a certain number of them, but it's a relatively limited number of them. Why? Because we're running out of them for our own purposes. This also happened with when we've been, you know, this has been really been kind of a World War II style battle in many ways. And a lot of the munitions that we were supplying, we also had to parcel out bit by bit because we were running out of them. And so when our adversaries are looking on, you can be quite assured that they are noticing that, noticing, you know, testing our own capacity to face a hostile and challenging world. particularly going into a new administration. And the shift between administrations, no matter what administrations they are, is always a very dangerous moment.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have letters, and we welcome yours. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from you. We have Jim Ketterer, Fred Hoff, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert on the program this morning. We will continue our conversation on these issues, move on, and also have much more. First, BBC News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 18th of November, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome your letters, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We are talking about President Biden approving Ukraine's use of long-range U.S. weapons inside Russia, which is a reversal in policy and came to the fore over the weekend, and we're discussing that. We got a note from Charles who says, NPR writes, a separate source on Capitol Hill, who also wasn't authorized to speak publicly, said the decision is unlikely to be a game changer in the war because of the limited number of such missiles and because Ukraine is already using drones to hit Russian targets.
Yeah, I think it's a valid point. I said at the outset, I think it'll help on the margins for the Ukrainian military, but the range of these missiles, 300 kilometers, about 190 miles. Russia anticipated months ago that this decision would eventually be made. So, for example, the aircraft it uses for these terror attacks on Ukrainian civilians, Ukrainian utilities, and so forth, these are launched now from air bases considerably beyond the range of the attackums.
So let's move ever so slightly to the story about the nominee for Defense Secretary of the United States, Pete Hegseth. So the there were two major stories that came out over the weekend about this particular nominee, and I think one of them is probably more important than the other, but I don't know. And so I thought I'd get both of them in. One reported by the Times, New York Times, a detailed memo sent to the Trump transition team claims that the defense pick said that an encounter with a woman was not sexual assault, but he did pay her off in this. And Trump has told advisors he is standing by his nominee for Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth after the transition team was jolted by an allegation he had sexually assaulted a woman in an interaction he insists was consensual. Mr. Trump made his view plain to aides after a conversation with Hegseth days ago after the team learned that a woman had accused him in 2017, according to two people briefed on the discussion. They also learned that Mr. Hegseth had entered into a financial settlement with the woman that had a confidentiality clause. On Sunday, the president-elect's communication director did not address Mr. Trump's thinking, but said President Trump is nominating high-caliber and extremely qualified candidates to serve in his administration. He added, Mr. Hegseth has vigorously denied any and all accusations and no charges were filed. We look forward to his confirmation by the United States Senate. Meanwhile, over at the Washington Post, there is a report there that says an investigation The Pentagon pick left the guard after being reported as a possible insider threat due to a tattoo. Let me go on. The day after the D.C. National Guard was deployed to secure a U.S. Capitol desecrated by January 6 rioters, a photo of one Guard member, his tattoos clearly visible as he emerged shirtless from the Hudson River after a charity swim, circulated in an online chat of military and intelligence officers. The soldier was well known among the group as the Fox News host Pete Hegseth. But in a moment of high national anxiety and with the guard set to protect the Capitol ahead of Joe Biden's inauguration, some in the chat raised concerns about his tattoos. Travis Akers, then a naval intelligence officer, told the Washington Post that he looked further and spotted a close-up image Hegseth posted of his bicep months earlier that clearly showed the Latin words Deus vult. Thank you. Researching the phrase online, Akers found that it was a Christian battle cry from the First Crusade in the Middle Ages, God wills it. Though the phrase remains in use among some ordinary Christians, especially Catholics, Akers said his research showed that it has become popular with the Proud Boys, Three Percenters, and other extremist groups that participated in the siege at the Capitol. Akers posted the photos to the app, then known as Twitter, calling the tattoos white supremacist symbols, an interpretation Hegseth has since forcefully denied. The tweet was forwarded to the D.C. National Guard's head of physical security, Master Sergeant DeRico Gaither, who soon warned the commanding general that the Latin phrase suggested Hegseth could be a, quote, insider threat. As he was about to be deployed, Hegseth, now the president-elect's nominee to be defense secretary, received a call from his superior officer ordering him to stand down rather than report for duty for the inaugural events, according to an officer later briefed on the events, as well as Hegseth's own accounts in writings and interviews.
Well, look, for me, you know, what may have happened in Monterey several years ago, or what kind of tattoos this guy has on his body, these are not the main issues. The issue with Pete Hegseth is that he's absolutely unqualified at this point in his life to serve as Secretary of Defense. His service as an Army officer speaks well of him, and I think ought to be respected. But look, I served as an Army officer for 20 years. I even served in the office of the Secretary of Defense. I was in the State Department. I was CEO of a small consulting company. And I do not think myself that I am remotely qualified to be the Secretary of Defense.
I totally
disagree.
But
what is it? Seriously, Jim, what is it about this guy that when he was approached with this unbelievable proposition, what is it about him that prevented him from telling President Trump, thank you, sir, but no thanks? What is it? I mean, all this guy's done, aside from respectable service in the military, he's been a commentator on Fox News. This is the best we can do to run a department that has nearly 3 million people and a budget approaching $1 trillion. This is who we want in charge of it. You know, and I get it.
I think you're forgetting the God wills it part of the story.
Yeah, and this may be it. The Deus Vult may indeed be the answer in the end.
I think the answer is that credentials, experience, fitness for the job have no bearing at all on these appointments, this appointment or many of the others. This has everything to do, this is right out of the handbook, to do with loyalty and beyond that, the willingness and the ability to be ruthless in implementing the new president's agenda. Credentials don't matter. There's no political blowback if there's no credentials. In fact, I think there's a great political support because he was on Fox, and maybe even more support because of the tattoos. So, you know, I think, sadly, we are applying the wrong litmus test. And if it had to be, you know, if credentials were the most important thing for these important jobs, from the perspective of not only the incoming president, but the incoming president's political base, we'd be at a very different point politically in the country now. But I think, unfortunately, that ship has sailed.
I will say, when I read the story about the tattoo, I wasn't surprised, because as someone that puts individuals, foreign nationals, in front of immigration officers, deals with CBP frequently, this is something we see all the time. I've sat in offices where they've seen a tattoo on my client's face and they've questioned, where does it come from? Who are you attached to? And it's determined whether or not they were inadmissible to get a green card. It's determined whether or not someone's been able to come and visit the U.S. So I wasn't surprised by the story where they would say, we're not going to take that risk when we see a tattoo for you not to be present during the inauguration. I thought it was something that they take very seriously, what you choose to put on your body. An officer told me, tells you a lot about what you believe in, and that's what people are always thinking about when you determine whether or not someone should be allowed to be a green card holder or enter the U.S.
But, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but if he wasn't on national television taking his shirt off while getting out of the river, it probably wouldn't have been an issue, right? I mean, that was part of the problem.
I mean, that was part of the problem. That's how they saw it, but that's what happens in investigations. That's what happens when you're looking. That's how they gather information.
And yeah, but I think that it's part of a bigger problem, and that is maybe just kind of a subtext in this story, but is a serious problem. And I would just say, if you step back from this particular issue with this person, or even step back from the case of the United States in general, one of the classic warning signs of a country that is falling into the authoritarian danger zone is the politicization of the military ranks. And this is something that the United States, for its history, its the norms of civil-military relations have really augured very well for us over our existence. And there have been warning signs for quite some time that the ranks are becoming increasingly politicized, and politicized in a particular direction. And that has not been the case throughout the history of the U.S. military. So this, if we were just kind of to say some unnamed country and this growing problem, would be one of the things that people would say, this is a deep concern,
watch out for this.
Deep concern, because once you go down that route, it's almost impossible, at least within a generation or two, to come back.
So doesn't that beg the question of what we were just saying about, wasn't it a good thing that they spotted that tattoo on his body and was able to make that call? Or
right,
saying,
and I'm saying that there are people who are concerned about this in the military and otherwise, who are looking out for these kinds of things. People are already concerned. And again, this isn't just something that happened recently or even just a few years ago. This has been a concern for some time, but it's becoming an increasing concern. And you know, I have heard it directly from people who have, in just the last couple of years, joined the military, enlisted in the military, and reported back what they are seeing, profoundly concerning the kinds of things that I've heard back.
So let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue talking about the story. A couple of things that I would like to explore. We always welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Hegseth has, welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We've been talking about the defense secretary nominee Pete Hegseth and a a pair of articles slash issues that have come up, one about sexual assault, another about these tattoos and the removal from a detail that would take place following the days of the January 6th insurrection. Hegseth writes, I joined the Army in 2001 because I wanted to serve my country. Extremists attacked us on 9/11 and we went to war, Hegseth wrote. 20 years later, I was deemed an extremist, quote unquote, by that very same Army. The military I loved, I fought for, I revered, spit me out. He went on to say he served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan and spent more than a decade in the Guard, and that he was floored by the surprise order. He was not told at the time the real reason he was barred from the inaugural mission. He wrote, "We don't need you, we're good," is what they told him, he recalls. Hegseth said he stewed over the ensuing days. He wondered if he'd been excluded because he was an outspoken Trump supporter, Fox News personality, or just because it was well known that he didn't like Biden. He became convinced that there was a cultural or political reason he was being kept away from the mission. He says, quote, "It was the strangest feeling, like my foundation had shifted, leaving me out of balance," Hegseth wrote. "The D.C. Guard turned their back on me. The message was clear. You were not wanted here. So I resigned on January 20th, 2021. I drafted the letter that simply said, F Biden anyway."
Yeah, I personally can't attest one way or the other to the propriety of the decision that was made to exclude him. What I think I know is that when people are putting together security details, both military and police, for the inauguration of the President of the United States, there's a lot of sensitivity, there's a lot of attention paid to things that people might normally overlook. And look, Jim, I agree with you entirely about the credentials problem we face. In the case of Hegseth, my understanding is that he was not even being vetted by President Trump's transition team. You could say the same thing for Matt Gaetz, not even being vetted. Now, look,
question that most of them have not been vetted, correct?
Many have. I mean, look, you know, Marco Rubio is right. a known quantity.
Yes.
Tulsi Gabbard, I don't think was vetted. But look, President Trump won this election. He's entitled to have a Secretary of Defense who aligns with his view that the Pentagon is spending too much time on diversity and wokeness and so forth. But why isn't it possible to find, you know, like CEOs of large corporations, defense experts in conservative think tanks, retired general officers? Why is it who align with President Trump on those views? Why is it not possible to find people who have actual experience leading large organizations and managing vast resources?
I think we can,
you know, walk and chew gum here. You know, I understand, for example, Senator, I think his name is Hagerty, Republican of Tennessee, mm-hmm. was considered for Secretary of State. Okay, why not consider him for the Department of Defense? We may not, necessarily agree with his views on everything, but having somebody reasonably qualified to do the job, I just think it's important.
I know, Fred. I mean, that seems logical. I think what's happening here is
sorry about that.
I was just saying that I don't think he wants to do what he did in 2016. Right, in 2016. He's, for the most part, he tried to get people that knew what they were doing, but they weren't loyalists. And so they were willing to stand up against him. And we saw that in this election when they came out speaking out against him prior to the election. And I think that's what he's trying not to do again. He wants people that are completely loyal to him and will execute exactly his vision for what he wants to happen in the country. I think that's what we're seeing happening.
I think loyal and as I said, will ruthlessly implement what the president wants. Also, I think there's a specific choice to move away from people who have a base of expertise and support and a long track record. Why? Because they're going to have a mind of their own. They are going to have thoughts of their own. They are going to have, you know, some experiences that may not align with the president's experience. And so if you put people in positions that are highly demanding and they're in way over their heads, basically they have no choice but to just follow every mandate to the letter from the boss, and there's no other story to it.
But if you're educated in a particular subject and you have the information and you know, and then you can actually say, "Nah, I don't think we should do that," then that's not serving the purpose of this, of the president-elect.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, I think we have to maybe rethink how we assess the ways in which this administration is going to operate and to kind of, you know, imagine that this might be some, you know, more conservative version of the best and the brightest. That ain't happening.
And also,
this is this is more just sort of like, you know, this. If you put in somebody who's massively underqualified, unqualified, basically they own you.
And he's a lame duck president. I mean, the idea is that he doesn't have another term, ideally, that he can run for. So why not? Why not put in the people that he wants to put in, the people that have been loyal to him? It's time to, you know, engender that loyalty to him. And that's what he's going to do.
Well, if this is his leadership philosophy, and if this is the philosophy he followed in private business, I guess it helps explain six bankruptcies.
But also, and I understand the point, Fred, but, I mean, let us not, and also I understand your logic, because it's, you know, logical. But the one part about it is that we keep on being told over and over and over again that, you know, this president-elect deserves the cabinet that he wants and the people that he wants in these positions and so forth. And this is what the American people voted for. And I don't know. Is that true? Is this what the American people voted for, the majority of the American people?
Yeah, I think so. And my only point is that President Trump can in fact have it all. He can have people with leadership and management skills, running large departments. People who believe in his views, and who will be loyal to him. Yes, and Jim, you're absolutely right. Somebody with a solid background in business or government or something, you know, is going to have her or his own views about how things should be done, and there will be some pushback. But what kind of a leader doesn't welcome and encourage pushback?
Well,
everyone says, well,
how much time do we have?
Yeah, I mean, Denise writes and says, all of Trump's selections are for PR purposes only, all for show. They're not going to be running anything. All the work will be done behind the scenes by the Federalist Society and Project 2025. Trump just is picking people to cause a ruckus, a lot of chatter, but don't be fooled. The media are all fools. Hey, what did we do? How did we get involved in this? We're just reporting this. I don't know. How are we fools?
I think we're sitting right here and we're digging into it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you look into it. I mean, I don't think I certainly have heard the Denise's thoughts expressed over and over and over again in various forms in the media as to what the idea is here behind these picks.
Yeah, and look,
what they're trying to do.
You could, I suppose, have, you know, in the form of Mr. Hegseth, a figurehead Secretary of Defense who prances around on the stage and gives speeches and so forth. But what this requires, and what you need in any event, even if you have a well-qualified Secretary of Defense, you need a really capable deputy Secretary of Defense. This is the person who normally manages the department. So if this nomination proceeds, and I have my doubts that it will, but if it does, we need to pay close attention to who's nominated as deputy, because somebody's got to run this thing. And the people who did, Project 2025 or whatever, unless they are nominated and confirmed in senior positions in the Department of Defense, they're not going to be running things.
We'll close with this letter from Beth, who says, it's not the goal to find appropriate nominees. It's about retribution and wrecking every element of the U.S. government that Trump voters believe need to be fully broken and left to the survival of the fittest. Everyone on the Trump wagon, down to the voter, has been clear about that. Government is not working for them, so we need to wreck it. We'll pause there. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. We'll move on to other topics. We will continue with our panel, Jim Ketterer, Fred Hoff, and Sienna Freeman-Tolbert. We also welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. First, regional news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 18th of November. Happy Monday to you all. We have a terrific group. Let me reintroduce them to you. Sienna Freeman-Tolbert is partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Ambassador Fred Hoff is a former U.S. Army officer and State Department diplomat who is now a senior fellow at Bard's Center for Civic Engagement. And Jim Ketterer is a senior fellow at the Bard Center for Civic Engagement as well. We welcome you all back. We also welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. And we'd love to hear from you. I do want to move on to other topics. I want to get to, we have other nominees to talk about. We got to have the Matt Gaetz discussion. So let me, before we do that, let me just go to a letter or two here. This from Dan. Jim is right. Sienna is right. I'm getting so frustrated hearing some panelists talk around the elephant on the table. Forget wondering why Trump is not considering people with more qualifications and experience. Forget about leadership and management skills. Forget about Trump's leadership philosophy. Trump is not concerned with leadership of the critical functions of the country. They don't matter to Trump. All that matters is loyalty. This is all about executing a successful coup. He studied why the last one failed, and he's positioning everything so that the next one actually succeeds. His goal is to install his loyalists into key positions throughout the government so they are in his pocket when he launches his takeover. This is a blatant move to corrupt the military and encircle himself with it.
I think that overstates things a bit. I have no doubt that what Trump is looking for is loyalists. He's obviously not looking for credentials. Possibly Department of Treasury might be an exception to that. But if he finds himself 6 months in and the apparatus he's supposed to be governing is being burned down, he may have second thoughts.
I guess my question about that letter, and I understand the letter, of course, but of putting people in and have for a complete takeover. But he already sort of has the complete takeover, right? I mean, you have the House, you have the Senate, you have the presidency, you're putting in who you want. I don't know.
What I think he felt thwarted last time by some cabinet picks who had their own experience and their own ideas on what to do, and also felt thwarted by the bureaucracy that finds all kinds of ways to resist and push back and delay. And, many presidents have been frustrated by this over the years. But as I was saying before, so if we just take the United States out of this and we just think about countries that are in some kind of precarious state, one of the certain things that leaders will try to do if they're trying to take advantage of that precarious moment is to make sure they're controlling the intelligence services, both outward, you know, international, in this case, you know, our CIA and others, and internal, maybe the FBI, the military and the judiciary. Congress, it's kind of easy, control them politically, and that's already in the bag. And then with your executive appointees, again, you want loyalty and ruthlessness. So that's kind of the playbook for any kind of generic, even if it's creeping, kind of takeover of government. That's how it works. And so part of that plan, though, also is to both undermine and cow into silence and cow into compliance that kind of mid-level bureaucracy. And I think that is something that really, really frustrated the Trump administration the first time and with their plans. And he seems really intent on turning that around this time.
All right, let's move on to other topics and go to Matt Gaetz and his run for Attorney General. And so the issue with Matt Gaetz, well, there are there are a couple, but as far as what we're going to talk about this morning is less about the overall the nomination and more about this congressional ethics investigation. So moments after he was named by the president-elect to be the nominee for the attorney general, the Florida congressman resigned. And one of the reasons that he resigned is because there was a House Ethics Committee investigating him. And if you are not then a member of the House, then they won't investigate you anymore. The problem is that the report that they were going to issue just a day or two before he was actually announced as the nominee still exists. And there are those who would like to have that report released. Now, let us not forget that this is a guy, Matt Gaetz, who doesn't have a whole lot of friends in the House or the Senate, partially because of the way that he went about unseating Speaker McCarthy. And then McCarthy, Kevin McCarthy, of course, really worked very hard to then go out against Matt Gaetz and make it quite apparent of what the reasoning was of McCarthy said, look, the reason I am not the Speaker of the House anymore is because Matt Gaetz, who has a history of sexual misconduct and illicit drug use, didn't want me to be the Speaker anymore. Damn. Okay. So then he... So now McCarthy's gone, and Gaetz is the president-elect's choice to run the Justice Department. Enter Mike Johnson, who was the guy that replaced Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House, and he is doing probably what Mr. McCarthy never would, which is try to make sure that the damaging material on Mr. Gaetz never sees the light of day. It is a fitting coda to 2 years of tumult in the Republican-led House, disorder that was exacerbated by bad blood among individual members. So there's the part about we're not going to release the report. Then there's also what's in the report. And then the third is that things were bad enough that there had to be a report, right? So those are sort of some of the things that we need to look at as we discuss this particular issue.
I think it's important to say, because I think a lot of people don't realize what the allegation is in this report. Eric keeps saying 17-year-old girl, but what happened allegedly was that he paid a 17-year-old girl to travel across state lines so they could engage in sexual acts. That's the allegation, right? Since across state lines, obviously, then, you know, the DOJ got involved and they investigated. They found that they weren't going to bring charges. what does that? I mean, that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It means that they could not. They didn't think they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he would be found guilty. That's what usually happens. There's all other, you know, avenues that they could have, but they didn't think that they could prove beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's why they decided not to prove charges. I think it's very important to say that. And then, following that, now we have this House report that's coming that should come out because the people deserve to know what they found. I mean, we've been down this road before. We've seen this many times. We've watched these investigations come out, and they all reveal very interesting things that maybe the DOJ wasn't able to pursue because they couldn't reach the, you know, the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But the House would be able to subpoena people as well and get information as well. So I think it's important that it comes out because it is a big deal. And he would be head of the Department of Justice. I mean, people don't understand how important that is and how, gosh, it's, as an attorney, you know, that is one of the, you know, pinnacles of success, pinnacles of leading this country. And to see it go to someone that even has any sort of impropriety is jarring.
Well, it's tremendously important, and again, I think the main issue with Matt Gaetz is that he's manifestly unqualified to lead the Department of Defense. The Justice Department, and you know there are multiple reports that Trump insiders were stunned by this announcement. I mean that kind of says it all. This guy was not being vetted by anyone. And look, I doubt very much that Matt Gaetz is going to make it to a confirmation hearing, and I very much doubt that the ethics report that Speaker Johnson wants to suppress is going to stay suppressed one way or the other. There is, I think, a sufficient number of Senate Republicans out there who would like to rescue President Trump from this catastrophic nomination. They'll demand the report. And if Speaker Johnson decides to try to keep it bottled up, I am certain it will leak.
So stop me if you've heard this one before, but just days ago, Mr. Johnson had said the Speaker could not be involved in the work of the ethics panel. But then he visited with Mr. Trump at his Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida, and he returned to Washington saying that, indeed, he could be involved in the work on the ethics panel.
Yeah, he got the word.
The word came down from high. Mr. Johnson on Friday cited the same institutional rules that Mr. McCarthy once invoked, though he has reached a different conclusion. He said that because Mr. Gaetz had resigned from Congress, the rules bar the committee, which only has jurisdiction over sitting lawmakers, from releasing material on him, though it has done so at least once in the past. Senators from both parties have demanded to see the report as they consider Mr. Gaetz's nomination to be attorney general. That could lead to a constitutional clash between the House and the Senate, which is charged in Article 2 with vetting and confirming presidential nominees. For Mr. Johnson, who is relying on Mr. Trump's support to keep his job, moving to block the release of the report could be the price of reclaiming his office in the next Congress. Doing a solid for Mr. Gaetz also helps Mr. Johnson curry favor with some of the hard right members whose support he will need while trying to govern next year with another extremely tiny majority. Watching from the sidelines, Mr. McCarthy has been uncharacteristically quiet about the whole situation.
Yeah, you mentioned the potential constitutional clash between the House and the Senate. And, you know, the founders of the Republic created a bicameral institution on purpose, and there are supposed to be tensions there. And, you know, it's really going to be very interesting to see how the Senate plays that role vis-a-vis the House. But also, and I think more of the clash that is coming, is between the Senate and the White House, which has already, I mean, right out of the gate, I mean, the day after the election results, Donald Trump was saying that the Senate ought to go into recess and that the checks and balances that are written into the core element of the Constitution and what operationalizes checks and balances. They don't just happen by themselves. These institutions have to do something to maintain and to make real checks and balances. So in the absence of that, and if they're, so you have a couple of things. I mean, if the Senate agrees to go into recess, that would basically neutralize that check and balance. What's even more potentially catastrophic is if the president, the incoming president, tries to use another part of the Constitution to force the Senate into recess and then to push through these very controversial, highly unqualified nominees and put them in place. There is the possibility that some senators could say, no, we can't, the Constitution doesn't allow that. We can't be forced into recess, and we can't be forced into it past a certain amount of time. And then you have the real possibility that the administration would say, we disagree, we're not going to, whatever, even if we lose in court, we're not going to follow that order. And then you have people in place, and then what do you do? Then what happens? You have Matt Gaetz as the Attorney General, or you have Hegseth as the Secretary of Defense, and you basically have an administration that's saying that we have prevailed, this is what the American people want, and that some misguided members of the Congress and in one or both of the houses are trying to thwart the will of the American people. We're going to ignore that court order. We have constitutionally declared that they are in recess. This is how we've proceeded, full stop. Then you're really off to the races. And what I have just laid out a few years ago would have been just sort of crazy kind of science fiction. There's a real possibility something like this could happen.
Yeah, there is a provision in the Constitution, apparently, where if the House and the Senate cannot agree on a recess,
right,
the president has the power to basically declare a recess. So one potential scenario is that the Speaker of the House moves to recess the House. If he succeeds, if he can hold this very thin Republican majority with Congressman Lawler and others supporting this. If he gets it through and the Senate declines to go into recess, then technically the president under the Constitution can declare it. Now, the intent of the framers in all of this was not to create a mechanism so that the Senate advise and consent role could be avoided and nullified. So to the extent conservatives are interested in the intent of the framers, this shouldn't fly. And in that connection, George Will, who is one of my favorite columnists and one of the leading conservative columnists in this country, has just published a brilliant piece in the Washington Post. I recommend it to all. He's saying that this is the opportunity of the U.S. Senate to have what he calls a Madison moment and just shoot down these schemes.
What are the chances of that?
I have to believe they're pretty good. I mean, you know, they're going to be 47 Democratic on the Democratic side.
Led by Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski is the Madison moment.
Well, they would certainly be key people. I think the incoming majority leader would be very important, Senator Thune. And who knows, now that Mitch McConnell is free of his leadership duties, we'll see how he moves on this.
Steve writes and says, okay, so what if Trump nominated very, very, very terrible people so that when they got rejected, he can nominate people who were only very, very terrible?
Yeah, that hypothesis that hypothesis is out there.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a possibility. Yeah. David says, how is it possible that a congressional ethics committee made up of taxpayer-funded congresspeople get to hide from the same taxpayers the results of that congressional committee findings? The level of hypocrisy, corruption, and secrecy here is staggering.
Yeah, Sienna, maybe you know this. Is that report something that someone could, you know, get via Freedom of Information Act? Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like if they block the report, you won't be able to get it through. It won't be, you won't be able to get it because they're going to, like, seal it.
But how, I mean, that act is just not applicable to congressional records?
I can just speak from my experience. Yeah. I do a lot of Freedom of Information Acts with the federal government. If they feel like it's if it's sealed or they don't have, they'll send it out to you, but they'll redact it.
The whole thing.
Yeah. So we do that quite frequently to get policy manuals and things like, and if they feel like it's not applicable or should not be released to the public, they'll redact it. They'll respond, but they'll redact it.
And meanwhile, this brouhaha goes on, but really none of this will start to take form until after the inauguration, right?
Yeah. Some of it may begin to take. It wouldn't surprise me at all if the Matt Gaetz nomination is withdrawn before Mr. Trump returns to the presidency.
Yes.
One thing about the Senate potentially flexing its Madisonian muscles.
Yes.
is that they did select Thune, who was not the MAGA candidate for that position. And so who really might be more interested in just kind of the institutional prerogatives of the Senate. And, you know, over the history of the country, senators have pretty seriously guarded those prerogatives. So it wasn't Rick Scott who was the MAGA choice. It was Thune. That might be some interesting insights into what is about to come on the Senate side.
It is interesting because Thune was the guy who, wait for it, was actually in line for the job.
Yeah,
like he right. was the next in line. He had prepared his entire life for that job, and was standing there waiting for it, and he got it. That's surprising.
I mean, in this case, credentials counted.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you remember that only really, I think it only really happened because it was, you know, they did that unanimous.
Yeah, silent vote.
Right. That's what they call it. Yeah, it's a silent vote. I don't think it would have been the same result if they would have been at risk of the wrath of Trump by doing a public vote.
Good point.
It is a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fair. All right. When we come back, we will wrap up our program and we'll talk about a couple more things. When we come back, I want to get to there's a debate over the Treasury Secretary, so we'll. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Elon Musk. There appears to be some pressure that Musk is putting on the cabinet, and aides are getting a little ticked. So, and I know none of us saw that coming, but it seems to be a case, and so we'll talk about that a bit as well. We welcome your letters. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday, the 18th of November. And we want to get to, as we finish up our time together, we have about 15 minutes or so. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. So last call for those. I'd like to talk about, we've been talking about picks for the cabinet, and one of the picks, which hasn't been announced yet, and we get to sort of see how the sausage is made, is that for Treasury Secretary, after a flurry of cabinet picks, Trump rethinks the candidates for Treasury Secretary. President-elect Donald Trump is expected to invite the contenders for the role, including Kevin Warsh and Mark Rowan, to Mar-a-Lago this week. And this is a bit of an aside, but I was watching a program over the weekend. No, I guess it was early. It was before my embargo. before I went into my cone of silence. But it was fascinating to me because apparently they'll have these discussions about different people, and then people will come to Trump and they'll say, well, what about this person or what about that person? And I guess, and this isn't a joke, but a lot of times the people who actually want the job are there and say, well, what about me? And there's a lot of that stuff. And then there's a big television. There's apparently a huge console. And then they press a button and they put up on the screen tape of the person. And usually the tape has them. It's not tape, obviously. It's video. But they put it up and it is of them usually saying nice things about Trump. And then at that point, it's sort of like who says the nicest thing, and then it's winnowed down, something I don't like about them, or there's something that this will work, or show me something more, or what else do you have? Or after the second one, Trump will just say, I don't like any of these people, find me a new group. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting. So this is now a new candidate for Treasury Secretary. Comes because they haven't found anybody that they like yet. And there's internal debate over who should have the role. The former Federal Reserve Governor Kevin Warsh. Mr. Trump is also considering the Wall Street billionaire Mark Rowan. Mr. Trump has been expected to pick either Howard Lutnick, the chief executive of the Wall Street firm Cantor Fitzgerald, or Scott Bessent, the founder of the investment firm Key Square Capital Management and a former money manager for George Soros. And he had been seen as likely to make the selection late last week, but he was having second thoughts about the top two candidates and has slowed down his selection process. He is expected to invite the contenders to interview with him this week at Mar-a-Lago. Mr. Lutnick, who had been running Mr. Trump's transition operation, has gotten on Mr. Trump's nerves lately. Wouldn't you like to know what did that? Mr. Trump has privately expressed frustration that Mr. Lutnick has been hanging around him too much and that he has been manipulating the transition process for his own ends. A person familiar with the process, who spoke on the condition of anonymity, described the battle between Mr. Lutnick and Mr. Bessent as a knife fight, with Mr. Lutnick as the primary aggressor. Mr. Bessent is said to still be under consideration and has also been raised by people in Trump's economic circles as a possible contender to lead the White House National Economic Council. Elon Musk, a close advisor to the president-elect, on Sunday called Mr. Bessent a business-as-usual choice for Treasury Secretary in a post on his social media platform X, while throwing his support behind Mr. Lutnick. Mr. Trump and Mr. Lutnick met on Sunday, and it wasn't immediately clear what came of the discussion, according to two people briefed on the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Mr. Bessent also met with Mr. Trump. The other two, as well as any other new names that emerge, are likely to be asked to meet with Mr. Trump this week, according to one of the people briefed on the matter. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I'd call this a soap opera, but it's not that entertaining. It occurs to me, though, if Hegseth and Gates can serve as precedents here, what President Trump could do is nominate someone serving time for crypto fraud.
Well, you know.
And then promise to pardon that person once inaugurated.
Now, to just further fan the flames here, Mr. Trump has told, this according to the reporting in the New York Times, Mr. Trump has told people repeatedly that he wants somebody really big for the role.
Well, look, he actually has somebody, according to the Wall Street Journal. There is somebody else being considered. I mentioned him earlier, Senator Bill Hagerty of Tennessee. who I think would be a decent choice. As I mentioned, he was considered for Secretary of State. I think he probably ought to be considered for Secretary of Defense as well. But who knows? I mean, trying to predict any of this is absolutely futile, because decisions are made in a very impulsive manner, often without reference to due diligence or staff recommendations.
I'll say really quickly. I don't know, Fred. I don't agree. I think that what Elon says kind of goes. In my opinion, I think Elon has a lot of sway with President Trump.
Particularly with Treasury.
Especially with Treasury. And so I think the tweet that Elon sent out in support of Lutnick speaks a lot. That was meant to speak to Trump directly, to say, listen, I have this platform. I'm putting out how I feel about this. And I think that was a huge, huge, I was going to say mic drop from Elon. And I think that's a really big deal.
You know what? I was also thinking about, Joe, when you were reading that description of the decision-making process and, you know, getting the accolades and getting them all lined up and on video and who said the nicest thing, and then things are just, you know, people kind of randomly come into consideration and out of consideration, and, you know, maybe it really has to do with somebody's been hanging around too much and it's on my nerves. And, Fred, you used the word impulsive. And what I'm about to say might sound like a joke, but I don't mean it as a joke. This is somebody, this highly unpredictable, unstable, impulsive character, who on January 20th will once again have the nuclear codes. And that's not a job I want for somebody who is impulsive, somebody who's unpredictable, somebody who appears to be deeply unstable. And so it's funny in a way that this is the kind of thing that is going on at Mar-a-Lago, but it's profoundly disturbing. And, you know, that we are now going to enter into 4 more years of this with someone of this character and surrounded by many other people who are supporting this is extremely dangerous.
I think you're overdoing it. in the first Trump administration, in the days after the inauguration, and do you all remember there was a party down at Mar-a-Lago, and they all had the football with the codes, and he was passing it around to people to take selfies with it.
I don't remember that, but
block that out apparently.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that happened. So, I mean, to your point.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't like, okay, this isn't, there's that.
But, you know, because the whole thing does kind of take on the air of the thing that made Trump most famous, which was his reality TV show. And this sense of spectacle, this sense of kind of constant, you know, edgy, unpredictable entertainment. Yeah, and I think that's been a large part of his sustained appeal, his mass appeal. And at the same time, the stakes are so high that it's not funny.
I mean, I completely agree with you. I think this is what we were talking about on break, is that I think, in my opinion, what the voters were thinking was, you know, he can make a better economy. He won't break our democracy, right? And I think what you're speaking to is that breaking of the democracy, breaking down our foundations, and it's terribly scary. I mean, the conversations around nominations of cabinet members used to be, you know, something that only the people that were really close watching the news were talking about or having these long discussions about, because it's a serious vetting. It's a serious vetting procedure. But now it's like trending on TikTok.
It's like an episode of The Apprentice.
It's like an episode. It's just like watching reality TV. What's he going to do next? Coming down the tube, the Treasury, you know, Secretary nomination. Who's it going to be? Matt Gaetz. He has a pending criminal case. It's okay. No big deal. And I mean, I think everyone's tired. I mean, that's why you had to take a break this weekend. We're exhausted. But it's happening. And we're resigned to it. And the question is, what do we do moving forward when they don't put a deputy in place at the Secretary of Defense that's actually going to deal with all these things? Or when they take away all the mid-level federal workers who keep the lights on and keep everything moving?
Yeah, and his supporters will point out that during his 4 years in office, apparently there were no incidents involving an unstable commander in chief toying with the nuclear codes. The difference, I suppose, is that he did have well-grounded adults.
Agreed.
In the White House, multiple national security advisors, very well qualified, and this is where the word guardrails comes in.
It wasn't with nukes, but he did suggest to the then Secretary of Defense that we fire missiles into Mexico and that the military shoot shoot American citizen protesters. I mean, those are just two things that we happen to know about.
Yeah.
So, the guardrails were there. They may be completely off now.
And that's why I don't believe when people say that, oh, he's putting up these nominations and he doesn't really want them to go through. These are very, very terrible. He has very terrible underneath. I don't think it's that complicated. I think he wants to get done what he was not able to get done in the 2016 administration, and he's going to get it done. And I was not encouraged by the senators who did a silent poll to vote in their person because they didn't stand up and say, we're standing against Rick Scott. They didn't say that. And so I'm just not as encouraged by it.
With that, we will hold for today. We thank you all for being with us. My thanks to Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Ambassador Fred Hoff, and Jim Ketterer. And thanks to all of you for checking in and writing. We appreciate your letters as always. You're wonderful. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Really good to have you. Thank you. We'll continue our conversation and more roundtable after this.